imagine signing a $100,000 contract for, you know, a software platform that is just supposed to completely revolutionize your business.
Right. The ultimate magic bullet.
Exactly. And then, I don't know, 6 months go by, you're bleeding cash, and, well, literally nothing is working right.
Yeah, that promised efficiency is just nowhere to be found.
Nowhere. So you finally decide, okay, we need to cut our losses, right? Let's just walk away. But when you try, you discover, buried in the fine print, that to leave...
Oh, I know where this is going.
You have to pay the vendor, like, another $50,000 just to get your own customer data back.
Yeah. It's brutal. That is the absolute brutal reality of vendor lock-in.
It is. And if you look at the business landscape right now, I mean, it's 2026.
Mm-hmm.
Especially for mid-market companies in places like Orange County, the pressure to avoid this exact nightmare is just immense.
Oh, budgets are incredibly tight right now.
Super tight. Security threats are, you know, existential at this point.
Yeah.
And there's this overwhelming, almost suffocating expectation that every single technology decision leadership makes just has to be flawless.
And the stakes are incredibly high. And I think the illusion that technology is just going to magically fix everything only makes it worse.
Yeah, exactly.
Companies are often just chasing the shiny object, right? They sign a contract expecting instant transformation, and instead
it takes forever.
Right. The implementation drags on for a year. Scope creep completely balloons the cost, and they realize they are trapped in a partnership that, frankly, fundamentally misunderstands their business model.
Which brings us to the core mission for today's deep dive. We are exploring a really brilliant source text today titled Software Vendor Exit Plan: How to Avoid Being Locked Into the Wrong Partner.
It's a great read.
It really is. And our goal today is to arm you, the listener, with a highly practical step-by-step guide to basically just pump the brakes.
Yeah, slow things down.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We want to help you slow down these major tech decisions just enough to ask the tough questions, evaluate the hidden risks, and really ensure you never get trapped in one of these toxic vendor marriages.
Because it really is a critical shift in perspective. You know, most organizations only start Googling a phrase like software vendor exit plan when they are already in serious pain.
Right. When the house is already on fire.
Exactly. They're experiencing massive operational risk, or maybe their vendor is taking weeks to respond to critical support tickets.
Oh, that's the word.
But the most terrifying realization for a business leader is waking up one day and realizing, well, their entire operation is running on blind trust.
Instead of actual documented process.
Yes. They discover they don't actually own their own workflows anymore. The vendor holds all the cards. And the text we're analyzing today flips this entire dynamic. It argues that the only way to survive a vendor relationship is to build the exit plan before you ever sign the contract.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to fix a vendor problem, or I guess to avoid one entirely, the source material says you actually have to stop looking at the vendor.
Right.
You have to look inward first. The single biggest threat to a company's budget is, well, it's making a tool-first decision.
Yeah, that tool-first mentality is the root of almost all software bloat.
Tell me about it.
It happens when, you know, an executive team sees a flashy new platform. Maybe it has some incredible generative AI features.
Oh, everyone wants AI right now.
Right, or maybe it has a stunning visual dashboard, and they just purchase it based on the demo.
Just off the demo.
Yep. And only after they own it do they sit down and try to figure out what internal problems they can retroactively apply this shiny new tool to.
Which is completely backwards. I mean, buying software without defining the specific outcome you need is like buying a state-of-the-art multi-million-dollar jet engine, hauling it back to your garage, and then, I don't know, trying to bolt it onto your commuter bicycle.
That is a great visual.
Right. Because not only is it incredibly expensive, but the mechanics make no sense.
Yeah.
The bicycle frame is going to snap under the torque because you never upgraded the brakes or the steering.
Yeah, it's not going to get you to work any faster.
No, it's just going to cause a spectacular crash.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the text really insists that leaders must start with the outcome, never the tool.
Okay.
You have to isolate the specific business process that actually needs fixing. Like, what is the precise operational risk that must be reduced?
Right. What's the friction?
Exactly. What is the specific friction point in the customer experience? And critically, what is the exact measurable metric that will prove to the board that progress is actually happening?
That's huge.
Yeah. Only after those parameters are totally locked in should you even begin to review vendor capabilities or data integrations or access rights.
Because, I mean, if you don't know the mechanical problem you're trying to solve, You have no framework to evaluate if a vendor's engine is actually the right fit for your vehicle.
Precisely. And starting with the outcome forces a very necessary and often really uncomfortable internal alignment.
Uncomfortable how?
Well, it forces the finance team, the technical stakeholders, and the executive suite to all speak the same language before spending a dime.
Oh, yeah. That never happens easily.
Right. They have to stop arguing about which software has the prettiest interface, and they have to actually align on a concrete business goal.
Okay. That makes total logical sense for, you know, aligning the internal house.
Yeah.
But if you have that outcome defined, who is actually on the hook to deliver it?
Yeah.
Because, you know, a business goal without a specific owner is basically just corporate poetry.
That is a perfect way to phrase it. And it's corporate poetry that will cost you tens of thousands of dollars in wasted licensing fees.
Seriously.
So to prevent this, the source demands a very rigid internal ownership model. They refer to it as the core four.
The core four, okay.
Yeah. Any successful technology plan requires these four distinct roles.
Walk me through them.
First, you have the executive sponsor. Their role is to secure the budget and aggressively remove roadblocks.
Got it.
Second is the business owner. This is the person who defines the actual outcomes we just discussed.
Right, metrics and goals.
Exactly. Third is the technical owner. They validate the digital feasibility, meaning they figure out if this new software can actually talk to your existing, you know, potentially messy legacy databases.
Usually very messy.
Always messy. And fourth, the operational reviewer. They confirm that the tool actually fits the day-to-day reality of the frontline employees who actually have to use the thing.
Okay, wait. Look, I need to push back on this a little on behalf of the listener.
Sure.
Because I'm imagining a listener right now who runs, say, a 40-person logistics company, right?
Okay.
They're working 60-hour weeks just to keep the lights on. If you tell them they need to draft a formal 4-person committee every single time they want to buy a new piece of routing software, they're going to laugh and turn this off.
I get that.
Yeah, it just sounds like massive corporate bloat that would totally paralyze a smaller, agile business.
It does sound like bloat until you look at the balance sheet of failed implementations.
Ouch. Fair point.
Right. But consider the alternative here. In a smaller company, the text clarifies that you do not necessarily need 4 different human beings.
Oh, okay.
These roles can and often do overlap. So the CEO of that logistics firm might be both the executive sponsor and the business owner.
That makes sense.
Right. And the single IT manager might be the technical owner, while the lead warehouse manager is the operational reviewer.
Okay. So the requirement isn't about, like, padding the headcount. It's about making sure the cognitive hats are actually being worn by someone.
Exactly. The responsibilities must be visible and explicitly assigned. Because what happens in smaller companies when these bases aren't covered is that the project just loses all momentum the second the kickoff meeting ends.
Everyone just goes back to their day jobs.
Yep. The vendor sends over, you know, a 50-page technical requirements document. No one internally knows whose job it is to gather that server data, and the project just completely stalls out.
You're paying for it.
Yes. You are paying monthly subscription fees for a product you haven't even implemented. So the Core 4 model is really your primary defense against that organizational paralysis.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, though. Because let's say your internal house is in perfect order.
Okay.
You know your outcome. Your core four is assigned. Your project will still absolutely crash and burn if the external partner is hiding their flaws.
Oh, absolutely.
The focus has to shift to basically interrogating the vendor. And the source provides a framework for this called a 2026 scorecard.
Yeah.
Because we aren't just looking for a good vendor. We are actively trying to filter out the dangerous ones.
And this scorecard is designed to be ruthless.
I love that.
It evaluates capability, security posture, implementation quality, and scalability. But the most critical component, and the one most companies totally ignore, is exit readiness.
Which goes back to the title.
Exactly. How difficult is it to fire this vendor, extract your proprietary data, and move to a competitor?
And the golden rule of the scorecard here is that everything requires tangible evidence,
mm-hmm.
right? Promises are entirely worthless.
Totally worthless.
You don't ask the sales rep, hey, can your software handle our complex inventory?
Hmm.
Because the answer will always be yes.
Of course. It's always yes in sales.
Always. You ask them to physically map out the workflow diagrams.
Mm-hmm.
You demand to see the step-by-step migration protocols.
What's really fascinating here is how the text structures the interrogation during this phase. It gives you specific questions to ask multiple vendors to kind of break past that polished sales pitch.
What kind of questions?
You want to ask them, what is your exact discovery process? What specific risks do you anticipate when implementing this in a company of our size?
Oh, I like that. Make them admit there are risks.
Right. And perhaps the most revealing question of all, what would cause you to hit pause on this project?
I cannot emphasize enough how much I love that last question. Asking a software vendor what would cause them to pause a project is, I mean, it's exactly like asking a general contractor what might go wrong when they start tearing down a wall in your house.
That's a perfect comparison.
If a contractor smiles and says, "Nothing, we'll have it knocked out by noon, it'll be perfect," you need to escort them off your property immediately.
Right, because they're lying or they're incompetent.
Exactly. You want the contractor who looks at the blueprints and says, well, you know, there might be cast iron plumbing in there or unpermitted electrical work from the 90s. And if we hit either of those, we have to stop, reassess, and bring in an inspector.
A trustworthy partner will always acknowledge the complexity of reality. They do not pretend implementations are flawless.
No.
In fact, a really strong vendor will proactively try to narrow the scope of your project.
Wait, really? Narrow it?
Yeah. They want to prove their value on a small, tightly controlled scale before expanding it across your entire enterprise.
Whereas a toxic vendor just wants to maximize that initial invoice.
Exactly.
And the source lists some very specific red flags to watch for. Vague scope documents are a massive warning sign.
Huge red flag.
Pricing models that seem suspiciously cheap up front. That usually means they are hiding exorbitant ongoing support and maintenance costs.
Oh, they'll get you on the back end?
Every time.
Yeah.
And the absolute deal breaker, no rollback plan.
Right.
If they cannot hand you a document explaining exactly how they will undo the installation and restore your old systems if their software crashes, your operations on day one, do not sign that contract.
Absolutely. If they lack the discipline to describe exactly what the first 90 days of your relationship will look like, they are simply not a mature enough organization to handle your business.
Which bridges us perfectly from the theory of choosing a vendor to the actual reality of surviving them.
Yes, the survival phase.
Let's say you've interrogated them, they pass the scorecard, contract is signed. How do you prevent the implementation itself from becoming just a black hole for your budget?
This is where the source introduces the 90-day lifeline.
Okay, break that down for us.
The intention behind the 90-day lifeline is to prevent that open-ended technology initiative that just drags on for a year without delivering a single ounce of measurable value.
We've all seen those projects.
Far too many times. So the structure is highly intentional. The first 30 days are fiercely protected. No major systemic changes are allowed.
None.
None. This period is purely about clarifying your current state, mapping the existing data architecture, and identifying the highest priority gaps.
Okay, so you're really just drawing the map.
Exactly. Then, in the next 30 days, so days 31 to 60, that's when you actually launch the pilot.
Okay.
But you don't roll out every feature to every employee. You isolate and implement the single highest value improvement. You solve the most painful bottleneck first.
And then the last 30 days.
The final 30 days, days 61 to 90, are totally dedicated to reviewing the cold, hard data of that pilot. You document the operational friction, capture the lessons learned, and the core four makes a hard, objective decision. Do we continue and expand the rollout, or do we pivot, adjust, or completely pull the plug entirely?
And throughout that entire 90-day sprint, the source gives us a mantra. It's called the four golden questions, and they have to be applied to every single stage of the rollout.
These are crucial.
Question one, what evidence supports this specific recommendation? Question two, who owns this specific outcome post-launch?
That goes back to the core four.
Exactly. Question three, what risks need handling before we turn this on? And question four, how is success measured at the 30, 60, and 90-day marks?
These questions are really designed to enforce discipline. They act as a circuit breaker to stop a team from getting swept up in the novelty of new technology, forcing them to remain anchored to actual business reality.
I really struggle with that fourth question, though.
Measuring success.
Yeah. It's incredibly easy to sit in a boardroom and say, we want this CRM to increase our revenue.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you actually measure a software's direct impact on that in just 30 days without muddying the waters?
Yeah.
I mean, if revenue goes up, how do you know it was the software and not just a seasonal spike or like a really great marketing campaign?
That is a great point, and it raises an important question about the mechanics of metrics. The text addresses this by insisting on leading indicators, not just lagging indicators like revenue.
Okay, you mean example.
Success metrics must be hyper-specific to the mechanism of the tool. So for CRM, the 30-day metric shouldn't be more sales.
What should it be?
It should be a 20% reduction in the time it takes a sales rep to log a new prospect, or maybe eliminating data entry duplication between the CRM and the email client.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. If you are rolling out an inventory tool, the metric might be a measurable reduction in system downtime during the midnight batch processing. The metric has to be tied directly to the workflow the software is actively touching.
But the absolute non-negotiable rule here is that you have to lock in these metrics before the vendor touches your systems, right?
Yes. The psychology behind that rule is fascinating. If you do not define the exact parameters of success beforehand, human cognitive bias just takes over.
We want to justify the purchase.
Exactly. Teams and vendors will subconsciously invent success after the fact. They'll look at whatever feature the software happened to execute decently and declare to the executive sponsor, look, faster report generation, that was our primary goal all along.
Which is a lie.
It's a massive trap that just justifies wasted spending.
It's exactly like hiring a new employee without ever writing a job description, and then at the end of the year giving them a glowing performance review simply because they, you know, showed up and made coffee every day.
Right, you can't run a profitable business that way.
No. But even with airtight metrics and a rigorous 90-day plan, the physical rollout is where things can still spectacularly fail.
Hmm.
I mean, if you don't build a safety net, the implementation can turn into an absolute nightmare.
And the source material is very clear about the implementation mistakes that cause these nightmares. Rushing the rollout without mapping the technical dependencies is a massive one.
Oh, that's dangerous.
Yeah. For example, a company might aggressively deploy a new inventory management system, only to discover on Monday morning that it cannot communicate with their legacy accounting software.
Oh, no.
Suddenly, invoicing is totally paralyzed, and the entire company just grinds to a halt.
Well, they completely underestimate the human element, right?
Training.
Yes, training is always an afterthought.
You can buy the most sophisticated AI tool on the market. But if the operational reviewer didn't ensure the frontline staff actually understands how to navigate the interface, they will inevitably abandon it.
Without a doubt.
They will quietly go back to using their giant, messy, color-coded spreadsheets because, well, it feels safer.
It's what they know.
Exactly. Another classic nightmare the text points out is over-customizing the software before you've even validated the core process.
Oh, I see this all the time. Huh? I've seen companies spend thousands of dollars paying developers to tweak the dashboard colors and move buttons around before they even know if the data piping into the system is accurate.
Yeah. And you cannot allow old workflows to run in parallel indefinitely either.
No. Why not?
Because if you give employees the option to use the old, comfortable legacy system alongside the new one, human nature practically guarantees they will choose the path of least resistance.
They'll stick to the old way.
Right. You eventually have to cut the cord. But you can only sever that tie safely if you have meticulously prioritized two things: security and documentation.
Let's talk about security for a second, because the text makes it painfully clear that this is no longer just an IT issue. It is a board-level, non-negotiable requirement in 2026.
It has to be.
Every single technology decision, no matter how small, carries a severe security dimension.
And the data completely bears that out. Even if a business is just procuring, like, a simple marketing analytics tool, they are still creating new vulnerabilities regarding credential protection, the handling of personally identifiable customer information, and, you know, the distribution of administrative privileges.
It's all connected.
It is.
Yeah.
The text explicitly recommends aligning your vendor security expectations with the rigorous frameworks provided by federal agencies like CISA, that's the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, and the FTC.
And just to clarify for you listening, this isn't just about demanding the vendor use strong passwords, right?
No, not at all.
CISA and FTC guidelines demand you understand the underlying architecture. You need to know exactly how data changes are logged on the vendor's side.
You need to know where the data lives.
Exactly. If a breach happens at the vendor, how quickly are they legally obligated to escalate that incident to your team? If they don't have a documented answer, they fail the scorecard. And hand in hand with that security is documentation.
Mm-hmm.
I really want to highlight this because people universally treat documentation like it's just administrative busy work.
Oh, we'll do it later.
Right. They say, oh, write the manual once everything is running smoothly. But the source material specifically calls documentation the clearest signal that a partner is disciplined.
And if we connect this back to our original mission today of avoiding vendor lock-in, documentation is really your only real armor.
How so?
Well, high-quality documentation, meaning detailed decision notes, complete workflow diagrams, comprehensive configuration records, and change histories. That is what protects the sovereignty of your business.
Right.
Because if your lead internal systems architect suddenly quits, or if the vendor's platform suffers a catastrophic failure, or if you simply decide the relationship is toxic and you need to fire them and transition to a competitor.
Which happens.
That documentation is your only map out of the wilderness. It ensures you retain actual ownership of your own operations.
Because if the vendor holds all the institutional knowledge about how your company's data flows locked away in their heads, you aren't a partner. You are a hostage.
A total hostage.
You are trapped.
And this is exactly why evaluating the true total cost of ownership is so incredibly critical. The lowest initial estimate for a software implementation is almost never the lowest total cost.
Say that again for the people in the back.
Right. A discount vendor who skips the documentation phase, who glosses over the CISA security reviews, and who refuses to provide a rollback plan might save you, I don't know, 15% on the initial procurement invoice.
Sounds great at first.
Sure, but they will cost you an absolute fortune in lost revenue and consulting fees when you inevitably have to untangle the operational mess they leave behind.
So what does this all mean for you? If you are listening to this and you realize you're current vendor relationships are built on shaky ground, or if you're gearing up to make a major software purchase this quarter, the source material gives us a very concrete action plan to start regaining control.
The immediate next steps are highly practical. First, rigorously document your current operational state.
Find out where you actually are.
Right. Be brutally honest about where your gaps are. Second, choose the single most important business outcome you need to achieve. Do not dilute your focus by picking five. Pick one critical bottleneck.
Just one. Okay.
And third, create a short, actionable plan that assigns the internal ownership that Core 4 framework, sets a strict timeline, and defines that very first measurable 30-day checkpoint.
It's really about translating that vague feeling of technological frustration into a structured, manageable process.
Yes.
Now, let's address a very real elephant in the room. If you are a mid-sized company in Orange County, or honestly anywhere in Southern California, you might be listening to this and thinking, I literally do not have a technical owner on staff who can audit a vendor's API documentation or evaluate their cybersecurity framework.
It's a very common problem.
Right. And the source text points out that this is exactly where the third-party ecosystem comes into play. They specifically mention firms like Technegian as a solution to this missing internal capability.
Which is a crucial lifeline for organizations lacking enterprise-level IT departments. Firms like Technegian are utilized specifically to step into that technical owner role so you aren't fighting a sophisticated vendor blind.
Right. You need an expert in your corner.
Exactly. They provide highly focused consultations to help businesses translate their raw pain points and, you know, compliance requirements into a phased roadmap for vendor risk management.
So rather than your business owner trying to blindly guess if a vendor's security protocol is actually robust, you can plug an expert into your Core 4 to help you build and score that 2026 scorecard.
Exactly. Whether an organization requires a comprehensive software audit, strategic guidance on a massive implementation project, Microsoft 365 environment improvements, or simply a managed service plan, bringing in specialized oversight ensures the scope of work is crystal clear.
No more vague promises.
Right. It ensures you know exactly what happens first, who is accountable, and how success will be proven before any capital is deployed.
It really all comes down to moving away from blind trust and moving toward documented, verifiable process. It's about empowering you to slow down just enough to make sure you remain in total control of your technology rather than letting your technology or the vendor who sold it to you control your business.
It makes you wonder, though, when we look around at our own organizations and say we implicitly trust our vendors, are we actually just admitting that we have absolutely no idea how our own internal processes work? That is a very dangerous place to be.